Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us today. More of Florida continues to reopen as local officials start relaxing constraints on businesses and daily life. Some restaurants in Palm Beach County are open with limited capacity starting today. Yet the number of coronavirus cases and deaths in the state continues to steadily increase. There are now more than 40,000 total cases and 1,700 deaths as of this afternoon. Now, there may be reason to be skeptical of the reported number of deaths. Florida's Office of Medical Examiners were releasing an up-to-date list of the number of coronavirus deaths each day. The state has stopped releasing that list and is releasing its own list instead. The Tampa Bay Times found discrepancies between the state list and the list released by medical examiners. Deputy Investigations Editor Kathleen McGrory joins us now to discuss this. Kathleen, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So Florida's medical examiners have been keeping lists of deaths during state emergencies going all the way back to Hurricane Andrew. Explain how this list is normally compiled.
Sure. Happy to talk about that. A few weeks ago, just as kind of some of the reporting that I was doing with a number of colleagues here at the Tampa Bay Times, we were attempting to get a lay of the land, right, to really understand what our local medical examiners were seeing here in the Tampa Bay region. So we started to reach out to several of them. And then someone brought it to our attention that, you know, if you really want to get a picture of what's going on in the state, reach out to the Medical Examiners Commission, which is kind of the medical examiners organizing body based in Tallahassee, and get a copy of our list. And I was like, oh, I didn't even realize that you guys keep a list. And they said, yeah, we do. And it's something that we've been doing in every statewide emergency since Hurricane Andrew in 1992. So essentially, you know, when there is an emergency, it is the medical examiners who, under law, have to certify the cause of death. So what the medical examiners will do in their local offices, there are 22 local medical examiners' offices in the state of Florida, they will do their investigations, and then they will send a thumbnail sketch of each case up to the Medical Examiners Commission in Tallahassee to be compiled into a list. Now, that list doesn't include the names of the deceased, but it does include their race, their gender, what the cause of death was, the date of death, you know, which medical examiner's office handled it, and also a little summary narrative kind of explaining where that person sought treatment, if that person sought treatment, any type of comorbidities they had had, and in this case, if the person had traveled anywhere.
And the significance of compiling this list, is it meant to be just the official count during a state emergency?
It is meant to be the official count, but it goes beyond that official count, and it's data that can be helpful, you know, kind of above just serving as a number. So while it is a count, yes, it's a lot more data rich than that, you know, and I, having spoken with so many of these medical examiners, you know, they know that that is data that is important, particularly during a public health crisis.
When did the Florida medical examiner start compiling a list for coronavirus deaths?
Yeah, so that they started to compile that list, you know, in real time. It was being updated several times daily when the first death started being reported. So that was in March.
So how did the data from Florida's medical examiners who were gathering differ from what was being gathered by the state, you know, both in terms of deaths, but also the demographic data? When did you start to see the differences?
That's quite interesting. So it was in the middle of last month that I learned that this list existed. And, you know, my reporting instinct was to get a copy of the list. So we did. And at that time, it was easy for us to get a copy of that list in its full form, completely unredacted. And the first thing that stood out to myself and my colleague, Rebecca Woolington, was that the medical examiner's count of deaths was about 10% higher than the official count of deaths coming from the Florida Department of Health. So we wanted to know why that could be, because it at the time, you know, that felt like a pretty significant difference and certainly something that was worth probing. So one of the things that we learned in trying to understand this was that there were probably two things behind the discrepancy at the time. One, the State Department of Health was saying that they believe there was a much more of a lag in their ability to count a death. So how they were counting deaths were they were having a team of epidemiologists in each county follow up on each individual positive test result and figure out if that person had recovered or figured out if that person had died. And that's a labor-intensive process that sometimes comes along with the lag. The medical examiners were counting a death, as soon as they were able to certify the cause of death. So that might have been faster. But two, what we learned was that they were counting differently, and they had kind of different standards for who was counted where. So the State Department of Health was counting a death based on the county and the state where the person had lived. So as somebody who was a snowbird, whose residence, was in Ohio, that's where they pay taxes, that's where the address on their driver's license was. Even if they had come to Florida at the beginning of the year, contracted the virus here, and died of the virus here, the state was not counting snowbirds, seasonal residents, and travelers in its state, only Florida residents.
At
But
what at one point the state had stopped releasing this list, right?
No, and the difference, just to finish up on that thought, was that the medical examiners were counting anybody who died in the state of Florida, so that's why it could be different. So
Yeah.
but yeah, so the state medical examiners were releasing this record, and I had gotten it. We had written a story about it, saying that there was this discrepancy. And when I called to follow up and try to get an updated copy of the list just a couple of days later, I was told that they were no longer releasing it anymore.
And what was the reason for that?
The reason for that, it wasn't quite clear. I mean, initially we were told that the information might be confidential and exempt under Florida's record laws. When I reached out to the Florida Department of Law Enforcement, which is the state agency that houses the Medical Examiners Commission, they provide administrative support for them. They said, no, it's not that the whole list is confidential exempt. It's just that we need to review it for things that could potentially be redacted. So it took them a while to give us a reason.
Is
So
there
there were.
any issue with the privacy of patients?
Well, see, that's what the question is. So it took them about 2 weeks to finally get back to us, and on Wednesday they did release a copy, but it was redacted, and it was redacted such that the cause of death was totally redacted, and the little narratives about how each person had died were totally redacted. They say that there is indeed, a statutory exemption for this, and they pointed to two parts of the state law that exempt the cause of death from death certificates. And they've also been pointing to a part of the state law that exempts patient records being kept in hospitals. But we've had people who study Florida's public records laws and who are experts and advocates look at this, and they say that neither of those exemptions should apply because this record is not a death certificate and it's not a patient record being kept by a hospital. In fact, these records have no names. It doesn't identify any patients. And even if it did, these patients are deceased, and the same privacy protections don't apply to the deceased.
I'm talking with Kathleen McRory. She's the Deputy Investigations Editor for the Tampa Bay Times. You could read the Times story about the medical examiner's office releasing coronavirus deaths lists by going to our social media at WLRN Sundial. All right, so Kathleen, policies have differed widely from county to county. For a while, Palm Beach County was releasing information from the medical examiner's office, but what changes were made in their policy? Why were different, I guess, counties getting different or being told, what they could release or not release?
This was quite interesting. So yeah, as you said, different counties at different points in the month were releasing their information or not releasing their information. Some, like Pinellas, were making the actual investigative reports available to reporters whenever they asked. Others were saying, we think that this is confidential, exempt, and we can't release it to you. Palm Beach had been releasing it. Palm Beach put a pause on releasing it for a while it looked at the law. And then ultimately, Palm Beach began releasing their figures too. I think that the most interesting case is what happened in Miami-Dade County. And that this is all based off of some terrific reporting that the Miami Herald did. But the Herald reported that the State Department of Health had actually reached out to the Miami-Dade Medical Examiner in March and asked them not to release their death information to the Herald, and cited a different statute in Florida law, a statute that applies to Department of Health records. And the county attorney in Miami-Dade read it, read this request, heard this request, read the statute, and then wrote a letter to the State Department of Health that essentially said, we'd like to be able to honor your request and withhold this information. However, we believe it's a public record. We don't think the statute that you referenced applies. And unless you agree to defend us in the case of a public records lawsuit that will no doubt happen, we're going to release this information to the public. And they did. And I think that act alone caused some questions as to whether, state officials at the State Department of Health, one of Governor DeSantis's agencies, had been putting any pressure on any of the local offices or perhaps the Florida Medical Examiners Commission to similarly withhold records.
Have you heard from any of the county medical examiners about, I want to know what their concerns are that they have about this data not being released?
The county medical examiners we spoke to wanted this data to be released. The county medical examiners were saying, we've been releasing this data, many of them since as long as they've been medical examiners, they believed it was public record. Several of them said, the work we do is funded by the taxpayers and the taxpayers have a right to know. So they were pretty puzzled, when the medical examiners commission, when this the their organizing agency, which is run through a state agency, stopped providing the information. They were really puzzled.
How has the state's stance towards transparency in its data evolved over the course of this pandemic?
It's been really interesting. I think in many ways you can say that the governor's office and the state have been transparent. I'm sure you've seen the dashboard that they maintain and the reports that they publish daily. Those are 600 plus page reports that have a lot of data on what's happening in the state of Florida. So in some ways they've been very transparent, but in other ways they really haven't. With regards to the nursing homes, for example, for a while they were giving a count of of cases in nursing homes, but not releasing the names of the nursing homes that had cases, and it took a coalition of media organizations led by the Herald, but the Tampa Bay Times was a part of it to put a little pressure on them, for them to start releasing the actual names of the facilities. So we've seen them be willing to give us some information, but certainly not willing to give it all. And, the news organizations of the state have really come together to push for more transparency in this data.
What new details have emerged about the impact of this virus on nursing homes specifically?
Is insofar as the science or insofar as the data?
Just the data.
I think we've been seeing more cases in nursing homes. We have a case, a nursing home rather, here in Pinellas County, where they're closing in on almost 30 deaths. So I still think this remains a huge question mark for us. What will happen? And some of the experts I've spoken with have said really all it takes is, one asymptomatic carrier to walk into a nursing home for that to create an outbreak that kind of becomes really out of control and spreads, in a county, perhaps even to the state. So I know nursing homes really remain something that folks are keeping really close eyes on.
Is there any reason to believe that this information, this data, shouldn't be available to the public?
From what I've seen, the data that the newspapers have been asking for specifically with regards to the Medical Examiners Commission, I mean, my understanding is that that is very much a public record, and that's the stance that our lawyers have taken and the stance that many other media organizations have taken. Of course, the state has its own interpretation of the law. They may provide us with the records we've been seeking. They may not, but we certainly believe we have a really good case.
During this pandemic, I mean, have you found yourself, beyond getting this data from the state, have you found yourself, in any other kind of challenging situations with the state trying to get information? Do you get the sense the state is being transparent, with anything to do with the pandemic?
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly been interesting, right? I mean, we have all of us as reporters across the state have been trying to get information out of state agencies, and the process has been slow, and it's been slower than usual. You know, I understand and respect that the state agencies are busy, you know, that they're dealing with a crisis. I'm sure many of their folks are also working from home and a little bit outside of their comfort areas. But look, you know, the reality of it is that getting this information to media outlets to get to the public is part of their job and a critical public service in a time like this. So it has been difficult, you know, and we have been really pushing for more and more transparency. And as I said, it's something we're going to continue to push for.
I wondered too if, because you think about all the different types of emergencies, situations that we've been in Florida, specifically, you think about hurricanes. What have you seen with the way the state and different agencies have dealt with this pandemic compared to how they've dealt with past emergencies? I know it's a different situation, but I don't know if the system that's in place is supposed to be able to handle any kind of emergency.
Yeah, I mean, it getting information in the middle of a crisis is always difficult, and it's always slower for the reasons I was just talking about. You know, but this is a public health crisis unlike anything any of us has ever seen in our lifetime. So it certainly feels a lot different. You know, when I think about kind of the communications infrastructure that the state agencies have in place to be able to get that information out there. You know, maybe those are infrastructures that have worked in the past, but you know, maybe aren't functioning as well at this point. You know, I'm really not sure. But I do know that there's still information that we are trying to get that we have not been able to get. And we're just continuing that fight.
Kathleen McGrory is the Deputy Investigations Editor for the Tampa Bay Times. Kathleen, I really appreciate the time. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
And you can read the Times story about the Medical Examiner's Office releasing coronavirus death information. Go to our social media at WLRN Sundial. Well, still to come, a photo essay that tells the story of those on the front lines in hospitals. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Thousands of doctors, nurses, and janitors continue to risk their health and well-being every day heading into work across South Florida. You may know someone personally. They don't have the luxury to work from home. Miami Herald photographers Jose Iglesias and Matias Ochner set out to tell the stories of these frontline workers through photos. Through a series of stunning pictures taken at hospitals across our region, we get an intimate look at the faces of these men and women. And I spoke with Matias and Jose recently about their process and the stories they heard from these workers. All of these photographs that you capture are truly amazing. You capture these pictures of healthcare workers, people in the front lines of the pandemic. And first, I wanted to get a sense, when did you get the idea to do this? Jose, I think that it started with you, right?
I originally saw images that were photographed in Italy by Associated Press of Italian doctors. And they did a little slideshow, and I said to myself, wow, what an incredible set of pictures. What a great tribute. Why can't we do that for our people here in South Florida? So Matias, myself, and Emily Michaud, we talk every morning on the phone, and we bounce off ideas off each other, and we decided that, hey, this would be a great thing to do. Let's propose it. I went ahead and wrote up a quick proposal, and with the help of Dan Chang and Ben Conark, they emailed all the hospitals with my proposal. And I didn't think anybody was going to buy it, you know, given that everybody wanted to keep social distancing, and I was asking to actually go to the hospital, and chances of infection were very high, or so I thought. But everybody that we got in touch with was very excited about the project, and they were willing to cooperate. That was a surprise to me. Like I said before, I didn't think people would be wanting to participate in the project. The whole process was very involved. We did get turned down by one hospital, But overall, people were very cooperative and were willing to give us what we needed to photograph these people. One thing that we did not have control over was the folks who were going to be photographed. That was left up to the hospitals, and they contacted folks that were dealing with COVID patients and told them what we wanted to do. Matias and I would show up a couple of hours before set up, and we wanted to make sure that there was continuity to all the pictures. So the sets had to be very precise. We measured all the distances between the lights and the subject, and we just went ahead and started shooting.
And Matias, I wanted your take on this. I mean, the hospitals chose who the subjects would be. So, I mean, did that vibe with you guys? Were you okay with that? I mean, obviously, I mean, maybe you didn't have a choice, but when they told you that, what were you thinking?
Yeah, you know, when we were, you know, coming up with the conception of the project, you know, we didn't think that they were going to let us in. So the fact that they, you know, gave us people, and, you know, obviously we wanted to photograph those who were in the front line with COVID patients. We were really specific about, you know, you guys can, if that's what it comes down to, you guys can pick it, pick whoever you want to, you know, bring to us. But, you know, they have to definitely be in the front line. And ideally we want to photograph them as they're leaving their shift so that we can get, you know, try to capture as much of that 12-hour period or you know, however long they're, how many hours they're working, you know, in a photograph. So that was definitely something that we were trying to do.
And was that something that you wanted, is to capture them not when they were going into their shift, but when they were coming out of it? That's the unique thing about these photographs, is all of these folks, they've gone through a full shift, and you could see it. They look worn. They look tired. They look like they've been through a lot.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's why, like, so, you know, for example, at Jackson, we were trying to schedule the time that we would arrive, you know, with like 3 or 4 hours before their shift would end. So that would give us enough time to set up the studio, quote unquote studio, inside the hospital. But yeah, you know, that was the whole plan, was like trying to capture as much of an honest portrait of them as possible. Right. And that all came up in the conception of the project, and we shared that with all the hospitals, and that was the one condition that we kind of wanted, was to be able to do that.
What's that conversation like? This person just got off this long shift, and you know what they're dealing with, and they've got to be tired and stressed, and now they're going to pose for a photo. I mean, what kind of conversations are you having with them at that point?
One thing that I want to clarify on that, we also had a small problem. We didn't want to have a whole bunch of people standing around waiting to have their picture taken. So we allowed the hospital to start bringing people up like an hour before their shift ended. You know, so all these people, even though it was at the end of their shift, it wasn't exactly when they finished working. Otherwise, you would have a mob of people waiting to have their picture taken. Some other hospitals were a lot more precise in how they brought their people up. Mount Sinai had a very specific schedule, and each person was scheduled to come up 15 minutes apart. So other hospitals were a little looser about it, and they just said, okay, start coming up now, and two or three people will show up at the same time, and that's when I would hold them. Matias and I, depending on who was shooting, would hold them outside the room and bring them in one by one so we can get a little bit intimate with them. That's the whole thing. We needed to be intimate. We wanted to be intimate with them. We wanted them to have a moment of peace or a break, so to speak, and have their picture taken.
I'm speaking with Miami Herald photographers Matias Ochner and Jose Iglesias. You could see their project, Portraits of Courage, The Faces on the Front Lines of the Coronavirus Pandemic in Miami, by going to our social media at WLRN Sundial. To both of you, the style of how you did it, I mean, is that something that was planned ahead of time? And if you could just, I mean, you know, it's this beautiful style capturing them almost like outside of their setting, but they're still within their setting. And it's this very close-up photograph of this person. Again, you can see the lines on their faces from all the gear they'd been wearing. But they were also posing in different ways. I mean, how did you decide on the way you were going to photograph them? Why that particular style?
Well, this is Matias. You know, for example, one of the women that I photographed, you know, was Carolina Perez Leguizamo. you know, I want to be fair, like, you know, we were photographing, you know, maybe at Jackson it was like about 24 people, so I, you know, there was not a super quick photo, but it wasn't like, you know, I had like all the, you know, an hour with the person. So you had to kind of ease them in and explain to them, you know, what the project was. So like, I'll give you an example, you know, for her, when she walked in, you know, the conversation was something to the extent of like, you know, hi, you know, I'm from the Miami Herald, and, you know, we're doing this portrait series on you guys, on the workers up in the front lines of the coronavirus. And, you know, what we really want to do is honor you guys and thank you for what you guys are doing. And, you know, as we're photographing, you know, I'd like for you to think about, you know, the patients that you're dealing with on a daily basis, maybe your family members who you haven't been able to see because you're self-quarantined yourself, you know, whatever it is that you're going through in your mind, you know, that's what we're going to try to capture in the images. And also, you know, as we were going through it, you know, sometimes people are like, oh, these aren't going to be great photos. You know, I don't look great. And I'm like, no, trust me, this is going to be very, very powerful. And you know, I think you can definitely see that in some of these images.
And Jose, you know, how did you guys set up? Like, you know, did they just give you a room? And again, you know, was there any particular part of the process where they wanted you to make sure that you were safe, but also that you were, you know, not being a risk to other people?
Luis, I got to tell you, I trusted the hospitals 100%. I knew that they were not going to put us in a bad situation. So I had no concerns about getting the infection. I really did not. On the other hand, Emily and Matias were a little bit more apprehensive about going into a hospital. And this led to lots of sleepless nights for me, because normally when you go into a dangerous situation as a photographer, you're going by yourself. You take the risks. At least I've always done that by myself. I never really brought anyone with me. If something happens, it happens to me. It doesn't happen to anybody else. And in this case, I was bringing Matias along with me. And a couple of days before we started shooting, another colleague of ours, Charles Trainer, said something that I had never thought about up until that moment. Is we as photojournalists cover riots, we cover hurricanes, we cover, you know, all kinds of catastrophes, but we never bring them home. This time around, we can actually bring this thing with us to infect our families. So the thought of me bringing Matias along and have him get sick kept me up for 2 weeks. I could not sleep. At the end, for those of you that are keeping count of who shot whatever pictures, I was completely exhausted. I asked Matias, go ahead and shoot the last hospital. I can't do it. I was just emotionally and physically drained.
For both of you, let me end on this. Jose, let me start with you. Every experience you have is something special. As a journalist, as a photographer, you know, that experience you take with you the rest of your life, a lot of amazing and sometimes difficult memories. But what has this experience meant for you compared to everything else you've done in your very long career?
I'm a lucky man. I have done and seen so many things throughout my career that I am so grateful for having, you know, chosen this career. I always wanted to do a series like this, and I never really got a chance to until now. And so I am really, really, really overwhelmed by the response of the doctors and nurses wanting to participate in this. And one thing that really touched me, I had a lot of touching moments with these people, but there was one nurse at Baptist Hospital. Her name is Jenny Poe. And I was taking her picture, and she was wearing all this PPE, you know, this plastic suit. And she just looked at me and she says, can you please just take a picture of me without all this stuff? And I said, absolutely. And that's the one that we wound up using. She's just wearing her scrubs. And that was like, to me, it really touched me. And again, there were a lot of touching moments personally. This has just been an amazing experience.
Absolutely. You know, as I was photographing it, you know, I realized that it was a very humbling experience to be able to you know, see, you know, be able to interact with the frontline workers and to, you know, get to tell their story. It was just very, very cool. And at the same time, it was an awesome experience for me. You know, I've been working at the Herald for 3 years, so I'm still at a, I like to think as a, at a learning phase of my career, and getting to work with Jose and even with other colleagues as we would bounce ideas. You know, it was an experience of growth and an experience of just, you know, just a very humbling experience.
You just heard from the Miami Herald photographers, Matthias Ochner and Jose Iglesias. You can see their project, Portraits of Courage, by going to our social media, WLRN Sundial. I have to say, beautiful photographs. And to all of those folks working in hospitals, thank you so much for what you do. Well, still to come, immigration and the pandemic. A court orders ICE to release detainees, but they've been transferred instead. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Immigration detainees in South Florida are being shuffled around. Last week, U.S. District Judge Marcia G. Cook ordered ICE officials to release hundreds of detainees at three facilities. She called their treatment cruel and unusual punishment. ICE instead began to move them to other facilities. Well, the Miami Herald immigration reporter Monique Madden has been following this story closely, and she joins us now. Monique, always great to have you back.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Let's start where this story kind of starts. It started with a lawsuit, and it was about testing and treatment of detainees. But what was the status of testing in detention centers in the first place?
Absolutely. So testing within detention centers was extremely low. I have reported a series of stories saying that anywhere from 1 to 2% of detainees in ICE custody have been tested. And the percentage has fluctuated according to how often they update their website. But basically 50 to 60, at some point it was as high as 80% of detainees that were tested positive for the coronavirus.
Were they even trying, or were they even able to do any kind of social distancing or quarantining of detainees?
Sure. So according to health experts, prison experts, and even court documents that really, really detailed the circumstances within detention, ICE detention, it was, quote, impossible for them to practice social distancing, which was a huge point in the lawsuit and perhaps the most important one.
We're talking with Monique Madden, immigration reporter for the Miami Herald. Monique has been reporting on and following how immigration officials are handling the spread of COVID-19 in detention facilities across South Florida. And again, you can find links to her stories on our social media, WLRN Sundial. All right, so Monique, a judge originally had recommended that ICE release detainees. Then a second judge last week said, no, release them. Why the change? What happened?
Sure. So the change basically was, yes, you have to release them, but she wasn't clear in her order to say that you could not transfer them. So according to former DHS officials, which I cite in my story, that's a very common strategy for the U.S. Immigration Agency, and that is to kind of try to bypass the lawsuit and any case under the microscope. So instead of keeping them at these detention centers, what they were doing is what they usually do, and that is just transfer them to another.
And they've been transferring them even before the order, right?
Absolutely. So this is a common practice. Unfortunately, ICE will not comment on transfers. They won't explain why they transfer or on any particular case or in general. All they will say is that, you know, they were transferred and that's it. So we don't really have a clear idea straight from the agency on the record on why they would transfer one individual, you know, 20 times within a month. They won't answer that.
So do we know how many, where were they taken, where were they transferred to?
So the Miami Herald has interviewed probably about 150 detainees during this pandemic. That's not counting detainees before the pandemic. And after speaking to all these people, we've come to the conclusion that they've been spread out all across the country, whether it's Central Florida, North Florida, Georgia, Louisiana, Texas, Arizona, they've been dispersed everywhere. It's really hard to keep track of where they go unless you're keeping a spreadsheet or some map or something. But why would reporters do that, right?
Good point. You know, immigration lawyers and advocates argue that moving the detainees to another facility is not going to solve the problem, might make it worse. What's their argument?
Sure. So their argument is, okay, we have an overcrowded detention facility down here in South Florida. There's a lawsuit here. What you're doing by transferring them elsewhere is just shifting the problem, because the detention centers that they're moving them to are not under litigation, and they're not under court orders to, you know, report every week or every month, et cetera. They're not under a judge's microscope in the sense of having to release any information.
Do we know how many confirmed cases there have been of COVID-19 in these detention centers?
Sure. So we know, and I'm going to look at the website as I speak with you, and this was updated Friday. 788 detainees have tested positive for the virus. However, only about 1,600 have been tested. So we know that in total, back when they started testing, the total population was around 32,000 detainees, although some detainees have since obviously been deported, some have been released, et cetera, per court orders that have happened across the country. South Florida is not the only case, if you understand what I'm saying. There are very similar cases up in Boston, in California, et cetera, that are doing the same exact thing.
But did I hear you right? Is it half the cases that were tested came out positive?
Yes, I don't have a calculator with me, but absolutely, yes. 800 out of 16,000. Yeah.
Of 1,600?
I'm sorry, 1,600.
Okay.
Yes, 1,600.
The reporting of coronavirus cases in these detention centers, is that the responsibility of ICE?
That's a tough question. If you ask ICE, they'll say nothing. So we don't know what they say, what their stance is, because they won't comment on that. If you ask immigration advocates and lawyers, of course they'll say, yes, it's your responsibility since they're being held there. Now, in the past few weeks, ICE has gone before judiciary committees, and the leaders have said, look, we just don't have enough tests. But we will commit to testing people before being deported, and they've committed to testing at least 2,000 detainees a month. The month has not ended yet, so we don't know if they've actually gone through with that. We're hoping that that is the case.
Again, talking,
get a better picture, better sense of what's happening.
Yeah, yeah. Again, talking with the Miami Herald's immigration reporter Monique Madden. Last week, a judge ordered ICE to release detainees from three centers in South Florida. Again, over the fears of spread of COVID-19, ICE instead is shuffling these detainees to other places all around the country. Again, you could see her stories. Just check out our social media at WLRN Sundial. There's a detainee that you've been in contact with for a while now and who's been transferred a couple of times, but tell us a little bit about this story.
Sure. So he started off, he's been in detention since late 2019, and he is from Peru. He's been in detention center to detention center, but we've been chronicling his journey since the beginning of this pandemic, which started off in Monroe County down in Key West, Florida. He was in Monroe. All of a sudden, Monroe County cut its contract. We broke that story. They still won't say why, but our sources are telling us that they cut the contract because of the conditions inside, and detainees just continue to get sick. So what they did is that they bussed this detainee along with about 50 others to the Chrome Detention Center in Miami-Dade County. What happened there is that, you know, let's kind of go forward present day, hundreds and hundreds of detainees now have been cohorted or quarantined after being in contact with someone who has tested positive. So this man was at Chrome. He is in a wheelchair, and that's very important to note, because during each transfer, he had to be picked up by guards, placed on the bus, taken off the bus, and usually what needs to happen if you're wheelchair bound, there's a special bus that comes to pick up, you know, those that are handicapped. So After Chrome, he was taken to the Glades County Detention Center, which is up in Moorhaven, Florida, in the Orlando area. And after that, he was actually transferred to Baker County Detention Center, up almost by in the Jacksonville area. So it's four detention centers in about a month and a half. And he is actually one of the named petitioners in the federal lawsuit. So ICE continued to transfer someone that was named in a federal lawsuit. And I have to report, and I reported this on Twitter, but not in an actual story yet, but he actually, about a day after my story ran, he was released. So okay. He is now home on an ankle monitor.
Okay. And what did he tell you about the conditions and the treatment and what it's like inside?
Sure. So his case is a little different than most, because obviously he's bound to a wheelchair. He can't walk. He's epileptic. He actually had an accident. He wasn't given his medicine, and when he was going down the stairs after being housed on the second floor, according to his medical records, he had a seizure and he fractured one of his legs, and since that day he couldn't walk. So he is bound to a chair. He says that there's no hand sanitizers, they weren't given any masks, and his complaints are pretty consistent throughout the four facilities. He says that there's no room, even in his chair. He's constantly being squished by other detainees, that the anxiety and the fear is enough to kill you. And that's a quote. He felt very scared.
And you talk about how there's the consistency from facility to facility, but you've also been in touch with a lot of other detainees. Are all their stories pretty much the same?
Yes, absolutely. And I want to mention that I have video chatted with a lot of them, so I've been able to see these facilities for myself at some point. That is true. I do want to note that I have visited two South Florida facilities myself in the past prior to the pandemic, and it's very much in line with what I've witnessed in the past pre-coronavirus.
What did the CDC guidelines say about, you know, how you're supposed to transfer detainees and how you're supposed to what the conditions are supposed to be to protect them and to also protect the staff?
Sure. CDC guidelines for detention centers and prisons basically says that the agencies should restrict transfers of the incarcerated or detained individuals to and from other jurisdictions unless it's medically necessary, unless it's an emergency, and or, quote, to prevent overcrowding. And I think that is why ICE is doing these transfers, according to a court hearing where one of their attorneys mentioned that caveat. So they are, under the law, transferring them out, but they weren't transferring them out until this lawsuit was filed.
So the judge says she wanted to see detainees released. The other thing, too, was a requirement that ICE file a biweekly report about the transfer of detainees. Have those been released to the public?
Sure. So their first filing was actually Friday evening around midnight. And those filings basically refer to the named petitioners in the case. So they're starting off with the petitioners. There are 58 people that lawyers have named that are in critical to serious condition as far as their health and extremely prone to catching the coronavirus and could be at risk of death. So those 58 people have taken priority. On Thursday, there is a class action hearing where the judge will decide whether or not this will be treated as a class action lawsuit. But in regards to those 58 individuals, ICE has contested that the majority of them cannot be released because of their criminal histories. So stay tuned for that story in the coming days.
But could immigration advocates use the CDC guidelines in their favor to say, hey, you're not following the guidelines, you're not protecting anybody?
Well, that's what they've been doing, and we'll see what the judge decides. It's all up to the judge.
Now, it comes back to the thing that you'd said before. Again, the judge said to ICE, release the detainees, but ICE is saying, well, yeah, but in your decision, you didn't say we couldn't transfer them. So really, I mean, where does this go next? Is the judge going to make another decision, or was she wrong in not being specific?
So I did write a story shortly after that talked about how advocates had asked her and stressed to clarify whether or not they'd be able to transfer. And she did make a decision, and she said, yes, they can transfer.
Okay.
So that has been set in stone.
Thank you for clarifying that. You know, in your conversations with detainees, what's their understanding of the virus? I mean, have they been educated? Do they understand the severity of this and what's happening?
Absolutely. So all they have, their portal into the outside world is basically TV news. So anytime the TV news has either aggregated our stories or, you know, continued the coverage of what's going on inside these detention centers, that's what they're watching. They don't have access to internet. So unless their families call them and read them the story, that's really the only way. And I have a lot of detainees who have been getting their news that way, where their wives or their spouses will call and actually read verbally the Miami Herald coverage. Now, most of them don't speak English, although we do print our stories in El Nuevo Herald as well. But they're relying on the television. And if they're seeing, you know, on the national news that there are cases in Louisiana, that's all they know. And to be completely sincere, according to them, that's what's killing them the most, lack of access to information, because they say that the anxiety and the fear is, it's what's crippling them the most. I think they do have a firm understanding of what this virus is because of their loved ones primarily. They have not been, as of a few weeks ago, they have not been really educated. They haven't received any educational resources as to, you know, what this virus is, you know, the history of it, et cetera. Kind of like, what, you know, we can easily go on Google and find out. They don't have that.
Yeah.
They're primarily relying on the news. Which I have to know gets turned off a lot, because if there's a controversial story, I'll get messages from all detention centers at the same time saying they turned off our TV. They're taking away our access to the tablets, because some detention centers have tablets where you can chat with your families. They don't necessarily have internet access. So they'll cut communication with the outside world for a little bit.
Yeah. And when they're speaking to their families, are they getting information about how severe the virus may be, for example, back at home in home countries?
Absolutely. Yes. So it's a very interesting chain of information and how that's kind of flowing. And to be honest, it could be very dangerous, too, because it's like a game of telephone, right? It's just never fun when it comes to that.
Yeah. Monique Madden, again, is the immigration reporter for the Miami Herald. You can find links to her stories on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Monique, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Louis.
And that is our program for this May 11th. Sundial is produced by Chris Remington. Sherilyn Cabrera is our fill-in associate producer. Our engagement editor is Katie Leprey. Our news director is Terrence Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director. WLRN's program director is Jason Zapka, and our technical supervisor is Peter J. Meritz. Remember, you can always download a podcast of this program. Search WLRN Sundial on your podcast app. So coming up tomorrow on the show, Palm Beach County has broken from Miami-Dade and Broward. Restaurants started reopening today with the plan of some beaches reopening this weekend. County Commissioner Hal Valachet has been advocating for the county to reopen for a while now, and he's going to join us, and he'll take your questions. Plus, how will tourism rebound from the pandemic? We're going to look at one of Miami's destination neighborhoods, Wynwood, and see how businesses are surviving and planning for the future. And what's it going to take to get people to wear masks in public places? Is it about incentives or punishment? The University of Miami's Dean of Business School, John Quelch, discusses quarantine fatigue and what economics can teach us about incentivizing good behavior. And by the way, I just want to remind you, in spite of all of this, you know, we still do have our Sundial Book Club. You know, each month we pick a new book, a new author, talk about the latest in the literary world of South Florida. We're not going to be choosing a new book for this month because, again, we're just kind of catching our breath here, but we're going to bring you some of our favorite interviews over the past 2 years. And we want to hear, what are you reading right now? to get yourself through all of this. I'm going to post I got a new book that I got on Amazon. I'm really excited about it. I'm going to post that up on the Sundial Book Club, let you know what I'm reading, but share with us what's going on with you. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks again for listening. As always, be safe, and we'll talk to you again live tomorrow.